This episode of the OCD Stories is brought to you by NoCD. NoCD have a free community feature within their platform.
I spend a lot of time thinking about how do you build a community in a way that is healthy, positive, and allows people to connect with OCD in a safe way. So the first thing you'll find is content about what other people are going through so that you feel less isolated with what you're facing.
I spoke to Anil, a community manager at NoCD. He told me about how their compassionate community can help support people affected by OCD.
But what you can see is that there are users who say, I'm working with a NoCD therapist. And then when you start to see that message, the questions are actually a lot more self-aware of saying, hey, you know, I'm actually not looking for reassurance when I'm saying these comments. I just want to vent. And that is a level of self-awareness where they know that if someone reassures them, it could get worse, but they're just trying to vent and trying to share their story. So that's what you start to see. You start to see where people who do say that they're working with NoCD therapists for sure, but a therapist, an ERP specialist in general, you'll start to see the self-awareness throughout time.
NoCD, accessing a community and an OCD therapist just got easier. For more information on therapy plans, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link is in the episode description. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 217 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview Dr. Celine Gelgic. Celine is a clinical psychologist based in Melbourne, Australia. And firstly, I want to give a shout out to all my Australian listeners. I don't think I've given you a shout out for a good, probably a couple hundred episodes, so apologies for that. I appreciate you listening. In the episode, I talk with Celine about her therapy story, what's happening in the brain when people with OCD get stuck on repetitive thoughts and intrusive thoughts, exposure and response prevention's role in getting unstuck from that thought process. We talk about motivation within ERP. We also talk about mindfulness-based techniques to support exposure and response prevention therapy. That was really interesting. What Celine has learned in the last 2 to 3 years of treating OCD. What she notices in her clients that seem to recover slightly quicker than others. We talk about being a Sherpa in OCD, this analogy, and we break it down. Advice for living with uncertainty. And then resources for people in Australia who have OCD. And then words of hope and much, much more. So thank you to all my listeners, and I hope this helps you whether you're in Australia, USA, Canada, UK, New Zealand, or anywhere else on this wonderful planet. So without further ado, here is Celine. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Celine Gelgic. Celine is a clinical psychologist and director at Melbourne Wellbeing Group, author of the book Treating OCD, A Clinician's Guide to Getting Unstuck. Welcome to the show, Celine.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And as you know, I always like to get people's, well, therapist's therapy story. So, you know, what got you into being a clinical psychologist, and then what got you into treating OCD specifically?
Yeah, so here in Australia, when we're doing our postgraduate study, we have to do a lot of placements or internships, some people call them. Mm. Where we have to go around to different areas and gain different experience, obviously. I was adamant when I was going through postgrad that I wanted to work with kids. Mm. And in my head, I was like, I want to be a child and adolescent psychologist and all this sort of stuff. But as part of that those placements or internships, we also had to do like an adult version, like an adult placement, and so on and so forth. And I remember being young and going, I really don't want to work with adults. Like, why do I have to do this? And throwing an internal tantrum. but, you know, that adult placement ended up being it was my very last one. I kept it to last because I wanted to do all the ones that I was seemingly interested in earlier. And they're usually the longer internships anyway. So I ended up at the OCD inpatient program at the Melbourne Clinic here in Melbourne. And it's really the only inpatient hospital program in the Southern Hemisphere, really. There's a lot of outpatient programs around the country, but it's the designated inpatient one. And I was there in 2010, so about 10 years ago now that my OCD journey started, I guess. And I absolutely loved it. And it changed the way that I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my career. And I learned a lot and loved working with not just adults, but the teenagers that were coming through too. And then I thought I can also do this with young children who were coming through as well. So I stayed there for 4 years. They offered me a job after that internship. And I absolutely loved working there and loved working with the clients. And every client, like no two clients were the same, even though they would have had like a similar subtype or something like that. But the uniqueness to everyone's story and their journey was just really amazing to kind of see them progress. And some progressed faster than others and so on and so forth. And it was just really interesting. And then through there, I started working at Melbourne Wellbeing Group as a private practice, which is what I set up to be able to do that as in an outpatient setting, because there was a gap. Unfortunately, there aren't too many clinicians here in Australia who work specifically with OCD. And so I thought, you know what, I can do this across the age range. And it was also then somewhere where the clinic felt comfortable to kind of refer off to. And that network of clinicians that they refer off to now has steadily grown since then, which is amazing. But yeah, that's kind of my story in terms of how I started working with OCD, and I haven't looked back. It's just been amazing.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. And you enjoy working with adults now after your placement?
I do. Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. So, you know, for someone with OCD, when their brain gets stuck on those intrusive thoughts or obsessions, you know, what's happening in the brain and why, I guess?
Yeah, so this is something I really enjoy talking about and do so with all of my clients. And what's the process that's happening is not uncommon to all of us. It just happens a bit more commonly, I guess, with people with fears, especially with fear that comes up for OCD and triggers and all that sort of stuff. So there are three different parts of the brain that are involved in this mechanism, I guess. So when people get triggered by OCD, it generates the intrusive thought. And if we have it, mostly if we have a negative association with that trigger, and it could be anything. So it could be people, it could be places, it could be objects, situations, etc. It can even be thoughts or other internal triggers, like an urge or something, or a memory or something like that. And if there's a negative association and it generates that intrusive thought, people then start to feel a certain way about that intrusive thought, because it is inconsistent with values and beliefs. Yeah. And because it kind of goes against the grain and it's making the person feel really uncomfortable, it's generating more worry thoughts. And when it generates more of those worry thoughts, there's the emotion center in the brain called the amygdala, which mostly regulates emotions as its job, starts to become super, super activated. And it doesn't really know the difference between real threat and perceived threat. And so it starts to release adrenaline and cortisol, like all of those stress hormones that activate that fight, flight and freeze response that people might have heard about. And when that's happening, it also shuts down our frontal lobes from working. And so our frontal lobes are the logic center of the brain, in a sense. We call it higher order functioning or executive functioning. And really what that means is that part of it's the part of our brain that looks after attention, concentration, decision making, problem solving, logic, etc., reasoning. And so you can probably now tell why that's a bit problematic, because if our emotions are shutting off our frontal lobes or turning them offline, then we're literally not physically going to be able to use our logic and reasoning and judgment and all that sort of stuff. That all goes out the window. And what happens is that the amygdala will problem solve, because according to the amygdala, there's a threat, there's a real risk. It acts like there's a real risk. And so it will talk to our long-term memory, which is called the hippocampus. And it will be like, quick, what did Celine do last time she was in this situation that made this go away? And so it kind of looks through the filing cabinets, so to speak, of all the memories and all the experiences and anything else that's associated. And we'll be like, oh, you know, she checked the door 10 times before she left the house, or she sought reassurance, or she did internal checks, and that made her feel better. And the amygdala is like, okay, great. So I'm just going to create this urge for her to do that. And so it does that. And so when we engage in that behavior, we get immediate relief from the distress that we're feeling, which then convinces our amygdala that we've done the right thing. Because we also get a rush of dopamine and so on and so forth, which then tells us that we've done the right thing. It makes us feel a little bit better in that moment. But as we know, through what it does, though, is it reinforces that fear and it adds more evidence into our long-term memory to go, oh, this is what we need to do to get rid of this problem. So when we have that fear response, which is accompanied with behavior and thoughts, it really gets cemented into our long-term memory. The brain's like, no, we can never forget this because I need to keep my person safe. And once we engage in the behavior and the amygdala is starting to kind of calm down, the frontal lobes come back online and look back on the process and go, what the hell is that about? That was such an overreaction. Like, why am I doing this? Like, why can't I just resist this? Or this doesn't even make sense. I know this doesn't make sense. Like, why am I still doing this? And so clients really can resonate with that explanation of going, like, I logically know when I'm not in the moment of OCD, I logically know this does not make sense. But when my anxiety is super high, I feel like I have to do something. I feel like I have to get rid of it. And so it then becomes what I think we're now understanding as, and the research is kind of heading this way too, as more of what we call an emotion regulation difficulty, in terms of if clients are learning how to regulate their emotions in a certain way that's not reinforcing of OCD, then they're not going to be reacting the certain way. And just anecdotally, a lot of my clients will be like, if I had the thoughts but didn't feel the way I feel about them, it wouldn't even bother me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because that logic is there. And so I think when it's explained in that way, clients can really resonate with it. There's a reason why. And there are tools that we can use as well that help keep the frontal lobes online so that they can exercise their logic that they already have. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the process, I guess. And so it just kind of reinforces it and people get stuck and they feel like they have to do more of the ritual to get the same level of relief as well.
Yeah, I like that. And I definitely have intrusive thoughts that aren't linked to OCD, and because there's no emotion attached to it, I can be like, oh, that's a bit disturbing, but let it go almost instantly.
100%, like
as soon as the anxiety attaches it to it, though, however, it's a different story.
Yeah, I remember while I was working at the hospital, there was a roundabout that I had to go through to get to work. And a fair few times, I had this intrusive thought of, while driving through the roundabout, I would have this intrusive image come into my head of this car smacking into the side of my car. I'd just keep driving and I'd get on with my day and it would fade from my attention and so on and so forth. And every now and then it would kind of pop up. But like you said, if I started then, like if I was panicking to that or having really intense anxiety, I reckon I'd find myself trying to find a different way to get to work, but then I might be late, and then that then impacts on my functioning and causes all these other problems that OCD does. And it really shrinks people's worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. No, good point. And so I guess what's sort of exposure and response prevention's role in getting unstuck? And also, if possible, to explain what happens in the hippocampus when we're going through ERP. I don't know if anything does, but I just assume if
it does.
The amygdala is talking to to the hippocampus, and then if the hippocampus has changed and actually now we're not going to do wash the hands 10 times, we're doing this instead.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. It just takes a while.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be discouraging, and I hope, like, so the thing with ERP and the reason why we need to be so consistent with ERP, because unfortunately with OCD, if you give it an inch, it takes a mile, is that the way it works is if we think about every time OCD, I guess, wins, I hate saying it that way, but like, you know, as in it becomes completed, the cycle becomes completed and OCD gets what it wants. Let's just say that costs a dollar, right? Or a pound. How can I make this internationally friendly? If then we do ERP and we resist OCD, but we're sitting with a lot of discomfort, a lot of anxiety, a lot of shame, a lot of doubt, guilt, frustration, whatever the combination of emotions are, let's just say every time we resist and we don't engage in the compulsion or the behavior, whether it's internal or external, then that might cost half of, like, 50 cents or half a dollar or half a pound. I don't know what it is internationally. Sorry, Stu.
That's okay.
In that regard, then, so it doesn't carry as much weight, right? Or the currency isn't as strong, I guess. That's probably the best way to put it, in the hippocampus. And so we then need to do more of those repetitions, which is why consistency with ERP is really important, because we want to add more money to the bank, so to speak, in order for the brain to then have a viable alternative. And really what that then does is it then creates those new neural pathways that is a viable alternative. Because right now there's a certain pathway that's happening and it's being used consistently and repetitively. And imagine that's why people often also feel like they're on autopilot with OCD as well. But if we're changing that and creating this new neural pathway through that consistency with ERP, the brain then goes, oh, okay, so it's not just this as an option, there's this option too. And eventually if that then overrides the OCD pathway, we then get automatic behavior with feeling the emotion, but it's not as intense. The intrusive thoughts aren't as frequent. They're still there, but they're not as frequent. And we can then do a better job at resisting giving in to OCD and those intrusive thoughts. We get better at sitting with those thoughts. So ERP is wonderful in that regard, but it does take time and it takes consistency and it's effortful and it's exhausting for a lot of clients. But, you know, it's just, I always say to my clients, one foot in front of the other. That's all we need to just focus on right now. In order to keep going. Yeah,
I like that. As opposed to kind of focusing on how big the task could be, just focus on your next action or your next step.
We're just adding more currency, more money in the bank. And the more we get, you know, the more of that we get, the easier this is going to feel.
Yeah, good point.
Okay,
so as we know, homework is a big part of CBT generally, or between session work, if people don't like the word homework. what are some of the ways you encourage people to kind of stick to that and see through the things that you have collaboratively set in session?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. I'd spend some time talking to my clients about the need for consistency and why that happens. And that helps a lot of people. That on its own is enough for some people. And for a lot of others, we spend a lot of time talking about their values, who they are as a person, who they want to be without OCD. Because there can be a lot of grief associated with that too, because a lot of people are like, I've been doing this for a long time, or OCD has been in my life for a really long time, and I feel like I'm cutting off my right hand. I don't know who I am without it. And so that really impacts motivation as well for some people. So we spend a lot of time talking about some of those underlying drivers for, dare I say, kind of hanging on to OCD, and then talking about their values in terms of what's important to them rather than what's important to OCD. And then we use those values as a bit of a compass. So it's very much an acceptance and commitment therapy based approach in that regard.
Yeah.
Of what we call values guided action. So choosing an action in that moment based on what's important to you, not what's important to OCD. And that can be really motivating for people to go, this is why I'm doing this. I'm doing this because, you know, I want to get my life back. I'm doing this because I've set X, Y, and Z as a goal, and this is what I need to do to get there. And I need to make room for all of this discomfort that's going on right now in order to get there.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that. And one of the other drivers that's come up for me, a couple of people said it to me, is around kind of the getting the motivation of doing ERP when, you know, the fear is so kind of scary, that they're almost so scared of facing what their OCD is telling them that they don't do the ERP. I guess, how would you work with someone that's kind of going through that?
Yeah, so in those instances when the fear is really, really strong, the main thing that we work on is just trying to work through that fear without ERP first. So we start talking about it, and this in itself becomes exposure because we're taking the lid off, we're bringing it out into the open. It's no longer just a set of thoughts that are going on followed by behaviours. So we're calling it out, we're talking about it, we're working through like how it's feeling in the person's body, what OCD is saying, how we can even just choose one of the smallest things and really chunk it down and make it a bit more achievable and bite-sized so that they can start somewhere.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where once someone is able to do even just the smallest amount, and even if it's just with me in the room and then they don't follow up at home, they then are allowed to, like, they then see there's a little bit of evidence for them to go, oh, okay, you know, my anxiety did come down, or it wasn't actually as bad as what I thought it was. Or now that I've said it out loud, it's actually not, you know, I think I can do this. And so it's really just about slowing things down and working at the client's pace, and walking them through that process so that they can get ready for that change.
Yeah. That's a kind of, chunking it down and making it manageable. And I guess also getting them those kind of quick wins.
Exactly. Points on the board. But it's tough. It's really tough. And some people who have been trying that might hear this and be really exasperated by it. And, it's for some people, unfortunately, the process goes a little bit longer. But again, the brain loves consistency. So the more we do that, the more we work on it, hopefully change will, it will, change will come.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Thank you. And then, part of your new book, which is obviously targeted at clinicians specifically, but it's based largely on mindfulness with exposure response prevention. So how can mindfulness-based techniques be used to support ERP?
Yeah, so a lot of people view mindfulness techniques as a bit of a distraction technique, but really if we think about it, it's OCD that's distracting clients, or, OCD that's distracting people from what they want to be doing.
Mm.
So what mindfulness does is it encourages them to remain in their present moment experience, but that present moment experience can be a whole lot of anxiety going on internally. Or that present moment experience might be a whole lot of intrusive thoughts that are going on. So it's really a form of exposure in a way. It's exposure to the thoughts that are going on. It's exposure to the emotions that are going on. And the response prevention aspect of ERP, which is trying not to engage in the compulsions, is urge surfing. So surfing the urge to engage in the compulsion. So it teaches people how to keep an attitude of openness and curiosity as opposed to a fear-based response towards the thoughts and feelings, so that they are able to then observe what's going on and notice what's going on, but not give in. So it's about responding rather than reacting. So the way I work it into ERP is we'll do an exposure task, and then I'll say things like, notice what OCD is telling you right now. Notice what you're feeling in your body. Notice what OCD wants you to do. Notice the urge. How strong is the urge for you to engage in the compulsion that OCD wants you to do? And then it's about, okay, now let's try and sit with this urge. Let's try and surf it. Let's try not to give in to this urge. So you can see how it's kind of ERP friendly, in a sense of we're really opening up to the experience as opposed to trying to change it or get rid of it. And we're trying to, you know, through that process, encourage sitting with that uncertainty of, you know, maybe these things will happen, maybe they don't, maybe they won't. We just have to wait and see what happens. So yeah, that's kind of how I weave it in, and clients really take to that to those strategies, those types of strategies, because they feel like there's something they can do. And what those strategies do also is, they kind of retrain the amygdala to not become so activated when it's triggered in that way, and it adds more coins in the bank, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I like that, and I'm glad you said it was basically exposure in and of itself, because, you know, I've heard so many times over the years people say they've tried mindfulness or meditation specifically, and it's just been overwhelming for them, because they're kind of suddenly. They've emptied their head, and now intrusive thoughts can come in. It's obviously a scary thing.
And it is, absolutely.
And you're obviously doing it with them and guiding them and helping them, so, you know, to make them more mindful of what's going on. So it sounds to me like it's making room, it's accepting and allowing the thoughts to be there without judgment necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Nice. No, I like that. And so next question then is, in the last sort of 2 to 3 years, what have you learned or what has changed about the way you treat OCD?
In the last few years, I've taken more of a, interestingly, more of a focus on what purpose is OCD serving for this client? That's been my main question. And that's really more for my own understanding and my own formulation of the clients that I'm working with to understand, because a lot of the time OCD is trying to protect the client from something there, and it might be an internal underlying experience. And it's like, well, what purpose is this serving for the client? What is it protecting the client from? And so that's been my main question, and trying to investigate that, I guess, with each of my clients has been really fascinating. And also then at the same time not changed the way I work with them in terms of tools and strategies and that sort of stuff, but really more in terms of how I'm interacting with my clients and the discussions that we're having as well. So there's the exposure side of things, which is incredibly important, but sometimes we hit roadblocks and we get stuck in treatment, or clients will do the first lot of triggers on their hierarchy and then get to a certain point, and it's like, okay, why this hurdle? What's going on here? What is this about? What purpose is, what's OCD protecting you from? And so when we tackle those underlying fears, clients can find that they can get moving again. And that's been really interesting.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've got a million questions coming up around that, but I almost don't want
to
go into it, because I think it might derail it.
That's okay. Yeah.
Yes.
We can leave that for another day.
Yeah, definitely. I've got at least 5. Okay. So... where's my next question? So is there anything you notice about your clients that seem to make progress slightly quicker than others?
Oh, yeah. People are going to hate me saying this. It's willingness to to make room for the uncertainty. The rule of thumb I use is, are you reluctantly willing to do this? And they're like, yeah, I'm willing, but I'm reluctant. Okay, then we know we're on the right. We know we haven't overshot, and we know we haven't hit too low either in terms of level of difficulty for the exposure task. And so I'm like, if you're reluctantly willing, just go for it. Give it a go. You've got your strategies. You've got, you know what you need to do. Let's just go for it. And so the clients who are more reluctantly willing take what I say with blind faith. That's the other thing, because, you know, you've got to trust your clinician, right? Like, and sadly, we've heard some horror stories with that what people have gone through and all this sort of stuff. And it's scary. And there are some thoughts you might not even tell your clinician just yet until you build trust in them, which is understandable. But like when clients take what I say with that blind faith, I guess, and just run with it, they see change, and they're consistent. It's the consistency too. They see change really quickly. But to be fair, they may not have been dealing with OCD for as long, or the underlying, like the development of how OCD came about for that person might not be as strong as someone who's had a trauma response or something like that. So it depends on the severity and intensity of the OCD too, to be fair.
Yeah.
But I have had clients who have had pretty full-on OCD who are like, you know what, I've been through the ringer. I need to, like, I'm ready for this now. And it's like, okay, let's do it. And they see change really quickly. So, yeah, it's really that willingness.
Yeah, and, willingness, I like that. I've heard it before in terms of from an acceptance and commitment therapy point of view of how willing are you to experience this?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that will vary day to day too, you know. Like some days you'll wake up and you'll be like, yeah, I'm ready to take this on. And other days you're like, oh man, I'm tired. I'm just exhausted. Yeah. And so you won't be as willing. And, you know, OCD is like, okay, I'm going to stick my teeth into you today, or like, you know, and then we feel guilty about that. But then that's when it's about exercising that self-compassion and going, you know what? Today happened, that's fine. What can I do to get back into it? So to keep going.
Yeah. No, I like that. And then on your social media profiles, such as Instagram, Facebook, you've got that you're a Sherpa in OCD. why is this and what does it mean?
So I've chosen the Sherpa as an analogy because we use mountain climbing often as an analogy for tackling OCD. So consider OCD to be like Mount Everest, and my role is to guide my clients up that mountain. And that's what Sherpas do. They guide people up a mountain. And so it's about saying, okay, I'm, you know, familiar with this terrain. This is what we can expect. You know, it'll be unpredictable every time we go up there, but these are the things that we can use to kind of help. So that's why I've chosen the Sherpa analogy, because I think it's a nice way to say I'm here as a guide to help you climb your mountain of OCD.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I thought that would be the case, but I wanted to ask it.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
It's nice. Yeah, I like it. Okay, so very general question, but just advice for living with uncertainty.
Advice for living with uncertainty, that's a good question. My advice is just go with it. Just go with the day and trust that and trust your judgment. And, yeah, that's, I think, probably the two that I would go with in terms of, 'cause that's, you know, if we go day to day, we're already living with uncertainty. Like your car might be parked outside where you're living, but how do you actually know it's still there right now? Or how do we know we're going to wake up in the morning? That's quite morbid, but you know, it's we plan and we do things anyway. We're already dealing with uncertainty, so let's just keep going with it. Let's just keep going with the day, and trust our judgment along the way as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And then sort of, so you're the first clinician I've had from Australia. Obviously, I mentioned Kim Quinlan before, but she lives in the States now, so I'm not going to count her. She might hate that.
That's
But
okay.
what resources are there for people in in OCD, in Australia with OCD, whether that's charities, support groups, events, and also ways to find effective therapists? Obviously you're in Melbourne, but where else, Australia's massive.
Absolutely. Sadly, there aren't too many of us, but we are around. I've got colleagues in Perth and Brisbane who work with OCD and Sydney. But they're also similar to me in terms of they don't then have much else around them. So the other thing I would do is get in contact with the OCD inpatient program at the Melbourne Clinic, because they have a little bit of a database of clinicians that they know that they can refer to. The other place that has a referral base is the Anxiety Recovery Centre of Victoria. And I know that's just Victorian based, which is the state that Melbourne is in. But sometimes they might have names of people interstate as well. That might be helpful. And the Anxiety Recovery Centre of Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation that run workshops, and they have a helpline. They also run support groups and that sort of stuff for people with OCD, but also for people with general anxiety and that sort of stuff too. So they're a wonderful organisation.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's great. And hopefully, the resources grow over time in Australia. And I always encourage people to start support groups wherever they are. If I don't always do that, but I have done it. And wherever they are in Australia, try and get a clinician on and just start a support group.
Absolutely. It is important. A lot of the hospitals, a lot of the private hospitals that we have here do have outpatient programs. But yeah, they're not like, if you know about them or your clinician knows about them, it's great, but it's not too easy to find them either. So, there's a lot that needs to be done down here in Australia for OCD awareness.
Yeah, well, I have no doubt it's
But we're
changing.
trying. Yeah, we're trying.
Yeah, exactly. I can see you're working hard at it. So, yeah, that's great. So,
Thank you.
no worries. So, just words of hope for those with OCD.
Words of hope. Just focus on one day at a time and one foot in front of the other. Because if we look at the entire mountain, it can feel overwhelming. And we just need to get through the day for now. But once we get that and we get momentum, then we'll keep going and we'll be at the top of that mountain before you know it.
Nice. Okay, so a couple more random questions now. So if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell her?
Stop trying to wish there was a fast forward button in life. And clearly, I couldn't tolerate uncertainty in my 20s. Because it's all going to be okay in the end. And I know I'm reassuring my 20-year-old self. But I remember really distinctly of wishing there was a fast forward button of going, if I could just fast forward 5 years and see how all this turns out, I'll be okay. I can get on with, what I'm dealing with. But also it's going to be like, stop wishing there was that fast forward button. Just accept what's going on and just go with it, because the experience is much more important than the end goal.
Yeah, good advice. It's definitely advice I need to take at the minute as well. So you've got a billboard in Melbourne. What do you want written on that billboard?
Oh, what do I want written on that billboard? Great question. So many things. This might seem a bit cheesy, but I would probably want something like, you never really know what's going to happen tomorrow. So just go with it. Yeah.
No, I like it. Cool. Is there anything else that you wish you could have said today that I haven't asked you?
No, I don't think so.
Perfect. All right. Yeah. Well, no worries. Well, I've really enjoyed this. It's been great.
Likewise.
Yeah, no worries. It's been great chatting with you and hearing about your approach to treating OCD. And yeah, we'll definitely get you on again sometime.
Yeah, thank you so much, Stu. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
So there you have it. Thank you to Celine for her time and to you guys for listening wherever you are. And don't forget, today's episode is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or check out the link in the description of this episode. Quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.